You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Rob Cadigan, author of Phoenixville Rising, just published in September. It's a tale told by a local author about a local town that's close to many of us, both spatially and emotionally, and especially to me and my brothers, because much of its subject matter deals with something, a building in particular, very close to our hearts. So welcome, Rob, and thanks very much for joining us today.
Oh, it's nice to be here, Sam. Thank you.
So we've sold in our bookstore probably more copies of this book than anything I can remember in recent times. So I think that's great for you, but I also think it really says a lot about what people think about this town and its history. Have you been surprised by the local reaction?
I have been. I think it's, I always saw it as kind of a small book about a certain small town and a book that has a real strong sense of place. So I was hoping that it would appeal to people beyond just the Phoenixville community, and it seems like it is, which has been great.
What's really cool about it is the cover is a picture of the foundry with flames behind it. And when I read your book, it's like when you're talking about Deacon and where he's sitting, I can see in my mind exactly where he's sitting, because when I first snuck into the foundry, where it was locked away by plywood doors, and I snuck underneath them and it was a dirt floor, I could visualize everything that you subsequently were talking about. Isn't that weird?
Oh, that's very weird. I didn't realize you were one of the original Furnace Boys to sneak.
Yeah. Not original, but probably one of the last ones.
That's true.
But yeah, I remember, because I knew we had bought it, but I didn't want to go around asking anybody. I knew the museum was in the front, but I just went around back and just, like, on my back, snuck underneath, just exactly like in the book.
That's great.
And was laying on this dirt floor, and we got all dirty, and got up and saw the boilers and the furnaces. It was just, it all came home to me when I read this. And, you know, my brothers, Richard and Bob, I'm giving them copies of these, of the book, so they can kind of get a feeling too.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a real coincidence. You know, I've interviewed all these authors, but I've never talked to someone whose book was something that I was intimately familiar with the setting.
I had no idea. I wish I had known. I would have interviewed you when I was doing the research for the book.
Yeah, it's funny because, I have the independent bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop, and when it first opened, it was in a store two doors down. And what happened, and I've forgotten the name of the gentleman, we had a grand opening, and he approached me and my brother, and he said, "Hey, you know, the foundry is still for sale. Do you guys want to buy it?" And Bob goes, "Yeah, sure." And that's how it started. And that's,
wow.
Isn't that weird?
Oh, that is very weird.
And then, you know, now we're booked for weddings for like the next 3 years.
Yeah.
and all these business launches, and it ties in perfectly with the title, which is, you know, this is our part in rejuvenating a town that well deserves it.
It really has been quite a rebirth and a renaissance of this town, and it's perfectly named. You know, you couldn't make up a better name for the town than Phoenixville.
No, it's definitely true. It's you know, and you can see it pushing along. You know, I was good friends with, I've forgotten his name, at Wolfgang Books.
Sure, and Jason.
Excuse me?
Jason Hafer.
Yeah, Jason. And, you know, that I really wanted it to make a go of that. Unfortunately, climbing 26 steps and losing a third of your customers because they were too old or handicapped made it difficult. But I love that place, and he did a great job with it.
It was a great little store.
I think he's doing well now. I know he's in the publishing business somewhere.
Yep, he stayed with it, and he's also writing, which is great.
That is great. So what I was going to talk about was, well, why don't you know? I always do this. I run off at the mouth. Why don't you tell our listeners and potential readers a little bit about the book for us?
Sure. Well, it's really about a man who returns to his hometown after many, many years away, and he revisits this tragedy that happened when he was a teenager hanging out in the abandoned steel mill. But the book moves back and forth in time between the beginning of the iron and steel industry in Phoenixville and the end of it, so between the Civil War era, the 1860s, and 1980, after the steel mill had left town and things weren't looking so good for Phoenixville. So it's been described as it's partly a coming-of-age story. It's also a crime novel and a historical romance, so it really spans genre.
Yeah, it's funny, the historical romance part, which I think is quite poetic, it doesn't... I thought first you were going to go one chapter, one chapter, one chapter, one chapter, but you don't do that, and I actually kind of found that kind of, I don't know, it's not an imbalance, but I found that kind of refreshing, because usually it just goes back and forth. I was wondering why you decided to do it the way you did it.
Well, I really started with two different ideas, Sam, of this. I had two different pictures in my head of this group of furnace boys hanging out in the abandoned steel mill in this old foundry building. And then I also had a picture of this young woman who was standing on a cliff overlooking Phoenixville as the town was being born, and completely different eras. And I really didn't know if this was two separate books or two different stories at the time, and as I wrote it, I realized that it really dovetailed together, and there were echoes between the two eras, and that was kind of the point of the book, was that the past is always present, that even during the Renaissance of a town like Phoenixville, we have to respect the history that's been here as well. And so I came up with this structure to tell the two stories in a way that was hopefully seamless and a way that would appeal to readers as they're reading one chapter. They don't want it to end, but they go on to the next, and then they don't want that one to end. So the feedback I've gotten so far is that it seems to work pretty well.
Yeah, it does. You know, it's funny because it's exactly like you said. I'm reading about Boone, Sketch, and Tara, and then I'm waiting, you know, what the heck's going to happen with Shane and Rebecca?
Right.
And you know, and you don't want to, like, you're not going to skip ahead, but you kind of do, and then you go, oh, the next chapter isn't about them, you know, what's happening with them? And what's also interesting is about what you're talking about in terms of time. When you're thinking about French Creek and the Schuylkill and the High Bridge,
right.
You realize that those are things like... My house was built in 1775. It has one of those gigantic fireplaces where people used to look into that instead of looking into TV.
Sure.
And when I sit there by myself, which I do quite a bit, you can almost feel the weight of the six or seven generations that sat in exactly the same spot doing exactly the same thing. And it's not that I'm not spiritual or believe in that kind of magical moment, but there's no question that you can feel it. And... you know, it's totally internalized, but you have this feeling of heaviness, but at the same time, import when you have those moments. And I think you described those well in the book.
Well, that's good to hear. I think exactly what you're talking about, that this sense of history, you don't want to lose that. And when we live in a place like Chester County or Phoenixville that is so rich with history, you really want to keep that alive in some way. My wife and I, we moved here, I guess, over 20 years now. And when we decided we were going to put down roots in Phoenixville, I wanted to learn more about this place that my kids were going to call their hometown. And that's how I got interested in the history. And also this, I wanted to challenge that kind of universal complaint that young people have, especially about small towns, that nothing ever happens here. And the more you learn about places like Phoenixville, you can see that plenty has happened here and continues to happen here. And that's really why I wrote the book, was to show that the past is still very much alive, even as the future is being born.
It's interesting because you write about one character who wants to get the heck out of there as quickly as he can, and maybe he doesn't. You write about another character who kind of wants to stay and do something but ends up leaving in a different way, and then you write about Tara, who finds a way out but another way back in, you know?
Right, and it all three of them represent, you know, different ways to look at home and the sense of home and wanting to belong, at 15 or so, most of us want to get out of home and be independent, but then there's this yearning to come back, whether it's literal or figuratively. And that's really what those three characters are about.
Yeah. And, you know, it's at towards the end, and I'm not going to give anything away, when Tara is, you know, doing what she's doing at the end, it's like, it was so poignant. And, you know, because you at the end, you tie the two stories together, not necessarily in the way that anyone expects, but by tying them together that way, with both Tara and Sketch kind of aware of what's going on between the two of them, but then leaving it kind of unfinished, I guess. You leave it up to the reader to decide exactly what's going to happen, kind of, or to go on some kind of flight of fancy at the end.
I think that's true. I didn't want to spell it out. I have my own opinion about what happens at the end, but I do think a book is a shared experience between the writer and the reader. So it's not a complete cliffhanger, but I want the reader to interpret and decide their own ending to some degree.
Yeah, and you set up all the exposition and the narrative for the reader to jump off, and I kind of did. I think one thing might happen, and just like you said, I think another thing might happen, one of which I wouldn't like, and the other one which I would like very much.
Right, and it depends on the mood you're in, I think, when you read it and when you think about the ending, what you hope happens for these characters.
Well, it's nice, too, because it's, I mean, I don't know if everyone would do this, but I read it in one sitting, and it's nice when you have that continuity going so that you do have the opportunity. Do you feel like, I mean, you're kind of alluded to it, but do you feel like, okay, it's done now, I'm done. I was watching this really cool biography last night about J.D. Salinger.
Mm.
And we have his new biography in the bookstore, too. But right. This was a documentary. And it's like he let these books go, and then what happens? You know, three different people who murder John Lennon and John Hinckley, who was involved, who shot at Reagan, and there was somebody else, too. And all three of them had copies of Catcher in the Rye with them. And one of the commentators was saying, okay, I can see it if one person does this because of my book, but if three people do it because of my book, it's very troublesome. So all he did was write it and let it out into the world.
Right.
And do you kind of feel that once you let it out into the world, it's the reader's book and no longer yours?
I do. I think by the time it comes out and people are reading, I've moved on to whatever I'm writing next. I have been a little surprised by the reaction of a number of people who have written me, or when I've met them, they've asked when the sequel is coming out. And I don't really see it as a book that lends itself to a sequel. I feel like this story is pretty intact, and there is an ending that can be interpreted different ways, and I think that's good. You know, I have a lot of confidence in the intelligence of readers and the imagination of readers, and they figure out the ending they want. It's not that ambiguous an ending. It's just I don't button it up completely.
What do you think that readers think that who aren't in Phoenixville, who live in Des Moines, Iowa, or San Diego, or Seattle, how do you think they approach this book, and do you think they'll be able to kind of emotionally attach themselves to the town and to the feeling that the town had?
I do, because I think a lot of the themes are very universal. The coming-of-age story happened for most of us, and these decisions that you go through in your life about what your future is going to be like really doesn't have to take place in one specific town. This happens all across the world. So Phoenixville is a specific place and time, but I think the theme is very much a shared experience and very universal for people. And that seems to be the feedback I'm getting, the reviews I'm reading, and the notes I'm getting from people is that it is appealing to people in Des Moines or in New York or places beyond our radius of Phoenixville, Pennsylvania.
How did you decide I mean, so much of it, especially because, you know, since I live in Exton, Lyonville, Downingtown, whatever you want to call it, and it's, you know, a 30-minute drive for me to go up and have a great meal or go shopping or go to the foundry.
Yep.
I mean, how did you decide when to take off and say, okay, I'm writing about Phoenixville, but I'm going to change stuff? How did you make that? How did that decision-making process go?
Well, I did it backwards. I wrote the story as a thinly veiled version of Phoenixville, and the town originally was called Wiltondale, and I did that primarily because I needed to change some geography and change some dates that happened in the real Phoenixville's timeline. I needed to change those for the sake of the story, and I was concerned that history buffs or longtime residents would be upset that I suddenly moved French Creek from one side of town to the other, or that Star Street now runs north-south instead of east-west, or something like that. And I actually was at a conference with George Pelicanos, the crime writer who writes almost exclusively about Washington, D.C., and he was talking about the importance of sense of place, and that he sees the novelist's role as chronic, as really we're trying to set a chronicle of a specific place and time, and through fiction. And so I told him that I had done this, that I'd created a fictional version of Phoenixville, and he basically told me that that was a dumb idea, in very gentle ways. But he coached me that. You know, if you have this real place that has all of this history, why wouldn't you want to write specifically about it? So I dropped the veil. I changed it from Wiltondale back to Phoenixville, and that really freed me to write much more specifically about this town. And the people who have never been here now want to visit Phoenixville, or they feel that they've been here because of the book, and that's a great feeling.
It's funny when I'm writing, or when anyone's writing, I guess, sometimes you forget that, I'm not going to use the word lie, but writers don't have to write reality. And even when you're writing your autobiography, you're not writing reality. You're writing what you think happened, which is not what happened.
Right.
So when you move streets around or directions around or creeks around, you're allowed to do that. And I think a lot of people have a difficult time when they write saying, oh, it's like when someone, like a politician, makes the same speech every day. I think he feels awkward and maybe, oh, I can't believe I'm making the same speech. But it's a new speech for all the audiences. And I think that's kind of like what it is. Like, oh, I can't move this street because that's not the way it is. But you have every right to.
Right. There's certainly some creative license. And it's also, I wanted to respect the actual history. And so that created a little bit of an issue because, well, I did a lot of the research at the Historical Society of Phoenixville. And they have these wonderful archives about the iron mill and the steel mill and really just the town itself. And so when I wanted to change something, I had to remember that I was changing something that really did happen. So I would say 90% of the book is very accurate, but it's not a history of Phoenixville. It's not a historical document. It's inspired by Phoenixville.
Okay, let's go into that in a minute. Let's take a short break, and then we'll come right back, and I want to talk about the column that made Phoenixville different. When I say column, I'm talking about in terms of steel. So let's just take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about that. Okay, Rob?
Sounds good.
Okay.
Marketing and communications managers, are you getting eaten alive by the competition? Are you hungry for fresh creative ideas? Lion's Share Marketing can help your products and services roar above the competition and capture the attention of your target market. Their full-service boutique advertising agency staff of strategic thinkers and creative professionals is ready to take a bite out of your competition with effective and unique marketing solutions. Visit Lion's Share Marketing to learn how they can help you seize the lion's share of your market. That's spelled LYONSharemarketing.com. Or visit them in Exton's Eagleview Town Center at 562 Wharton Boulevard. The Town Center Pharmacy in the Eagleview Corporate Center in Exton is a family-owned and operated pharmacy where you'll find them across the street from the Brickside Grill and the Eagleview YMCA. The Town Center Pharmacy is a one-stop shop for all your medical needs and more, from band-aids to wheelchairs and a lot more in between. The Town Center Pharmacy not only provides you with prescriptions at the same copay as other pharmacists, but also gives you individual attention and excellent service you simply will not get at large chain stores. Your relationship with your pharmacist is important, and that's why they make it a priority to provide nothing but the very best in professional service to their patients. By the way, the Town Center Pharmacy also offers free deliveries to all nursing homes. Call 610-458-3767 or visit them at 606 Wharton Boulevard in the Eagleview Corporate Center in Exton.
Okay, we're back with Rob Cadigan, author of Phoenixville Rising, and we've been talking about the town, what it went through, how its ups and downs, and what a great name the town has, because it has risen from the ashes at least one time and perhaps twice. But one time it rose, and I guess the first time is because, if you could tell us a story about the steel column that was engineered by whoever it was engineered by, and how that changed the nature of the foundry and what it was able to accomplish both monetarily in terms of changing our country.
Well, I think the very beginning of the iron mill, it was a prosperous business. The community was thriving. But as the infrastructure of America was being built, whether through the railroads or the bridges, there was a need for iron and steel that Phoenixville was not able to provide, or there was a lot of competition to provide this. And the founders of the iron mill came up with the Phoenix Column, which, as I understand it, is a certain design with the way the wrought iron is within the column. And I'm a bit out of my league on this, but as I understand it, this column was used in bridges and railroad bridges primarily across the country. And that led to them spinning off a bridge company, a separate bridge company, from the Phoenix Iron Mill. And the column really went on to be used all over the world and still is in certain structures.
Yeah, it's funny because when Bob Tomaso, who is our director at the foundry, gives his tour, and he loves giving this incredible tour of the foundry, and he talks about the column, and we have preserved one of the cross sections of the column, and you can see how the flanges and the rivets, yeah, really make it so much stronger, and you can't really intuit it in your mind until you actually see it, but you can see how the structure of anything, whether it's a bridge, or I guess the other story is about the guy, about Eiffel, and the Eiffel Tower, that he was touring America and saw that column, and then when he went back, he actually used that technique in order to build the tower.
Yeah, he basically borrowed the design, I guess is a nice way to put it.
Yeah, it's that to me is one of the most amazing things of how Phoenixville, at its height, was in fact an effect that resonated throughout the world, like you just said.
Yeah, and it really was an incredibly thriving business and community, and which made the fall all the more remarkable. And by the time it got to the 1970s and early 80s, the town had changed quite a bit.
Yeah, like many steel towns, you know, like Bethlehem Steel and U.S. Steel, you know, the whole city relied on that enterprise. But just like lots of like college towns, too. You know, what would State College be without Penn State University?
That's right.
It wouldn't be anything. But yeah, so that to me is a very important factor, the way that you described it. But what about in your second story, the story that deals with the Civil War, what about Elijah and the idea that, where did the idea come from, or was it in fact true that there was profiteering perhaps done during the war by the owners of the foundry?
I don't know if it ever got all the way to profiteering, but they invented the Griffin gun here in Phoenixville, which some consider the gun that won the war for the Civil War. It was used at Gettysburg, and there are still Griffin guns in different battlefields, different battlegrounds that you can see. And just like the bridge company, the Griffin gun was a very important part of the Phoenix iron and steel business.
That's an interesting scene and kind of funny, too, where the general doesn't want to really hear anything about it. He just says, you know, show me the gun, how it works. And once he sees it for the first time, he goes, okay, that's it.
And that did happen. They ordered, I think it was 1,200 or 1,400 guns directly from Phoenix Iron and Steel.
It's funny. It's almost like had they gone on in the same fashion, it's also almost like Steve Jobs with Apple. You know, it's like providing people with things they didn't know they wanted. And it really is a shame, almost a tragedy, when you think of the fact that they didn't keep doing that. You know, it's hard to reinvent a business, especially back then.
And, right. I think in some ways it was a victim of its own success. It became much bigger and much more bureaucratic. As I understand it, there was infighting, and then there was competition from around the world that also made it more difficult. So the end was dragged out for much longer than it really needed to, and it made it for a pretty tough existence for Phoenixville residents. A good decade or so.
It's funny, I was just reading today about BlackBerry. Taking it private didn't work, so BlackBerry that everybody in the world used is pretty much no more. It's kind of like Kmart could have been Target. Sears could have been the Internet. Everything they had in the catalog was already numbered. They could have been the Amazon, JCPenney's, all those companies that there's so much inertia and, like you said, sometimes infighting and differences in opinion is how to proceed. And while they're thinking about it, it's like what John Lennon said, you know, life is what happens when you're busy doing other things.
That's true. And I think for the characters of the book, they are faced with, when you're dealing with Sketch and Tara and Boo, these are three 15-year-old kids who, their future has been defined. They know they're going to go work for the steel mill just like their families have for generations. And then when the steel mill is gone, they're faced with this uncertain future, and they have to invent their own future. And I think that's exactly what companies need to do, and the companies that can't respond to that go under, and individuals as well. That we have this opportunity, we all hit the forks in the road, and we decide: do we go forward or do we stick with what's not working?
It's funny, rather than me giving away spoilers, I mean, you have really a lot of developed characters. You have Boo, Sketch, Deacon, you have Shane and Rebecca, you have Tara. You even have characters like Little Hal and Big Hal that are developed, even though there's not much said about them. Why don't you, like I said, without me spoiling anything, tell the readers, listeners, as much as you can about the three different main people in the book. Boo, the young, sickly, kind of almost skeletal person who has certain ideas. Sketch, who really is the protagonist, who has a wonderful talent, doesn't really want to use it because who knows why. And then Tara, who is this, in my mind, beautiful young girl who's rebellious but at the same time knows the difference between right and wrong, which sometimes Boo and Sketch have a problem with.
Right, they do. Well, I think they all represent different facets of what we're all like at 15, I think. But Boo, more than anything, he wants to be a furnace boy, which is part of this gang that hangs out in the abandoned steel mill, and that's his whole dream. That's all he wants. Sketch, more than anything, wants to get out of Phoenixville. He sees that it's dying. He sees that his future is not in that town anymore. He just doesn't know how to get out. He doesn't have the confidence in his own artistic abilities. He doesn't see that he has a gift that he can use to get out of town. So he's caught right at that fork in the road. And then there's Tara, who has bounced around the country, has grown up in different towns, and she's really just in search of a place to call home. And she sees all the good that is still in Phoenixville, even as the steel mill is going under, and even as the town seems so dark, she sees a lot of light. She sees the potential and the possibility for the town. So through those three characters, we look at Phoenixville, and Phoenixville really becomes the fourth main character in the book. In many ways, while it is the story of Sketch and Boo and Tara and the story of Rebecca and Shane at the Civil War era, it's primarily the story of Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, told through fiction.
And it's interesting, too, because just like the story ends in a somewhat ambiguous fashion, the story of Phoenixville ends that way, too. I mean, you've lived there for 20 years. I've known about it for most of my life. I've been there as late as yesterday. So what's Phoenixville's future? You know, is it the same as, like, Manayunk's? Is it the same as, I don't know, Fishtown? Is it the same as someplace down in Philadelphia that's about to undergo a gentrification? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think the future is still being written, but the good part about that is that Phoenixville as a community has come through this dark period, and it really sticks together now. I mean, the school system is a wonderful school system. The community, what they have done with businesses along Bridge Street and Main Street, there's so many events and so many cultural things to do in town that I'm very optimistic about whatever comes next year or next decade, the way this town is developing. So it tends to come in waves. It started, I think, with the Colonial Theater and the renaissance of that, and then the Foundry, and then certain restaurants came in. And it really has a great college town vibe, even though there isn't a college right here in town. There's Ursinus and other colleges nearby. But it's a wonderful mix of a lot of youthful energy and proud generations who've been here for a long, long time.
Two things. One is, you know, how you make in the book the library very important. And it is important. It's a thriving library and kind of different in a way. You know, that's where a book signing, book reading is done, and you have a person, a moderator, who may be a little pompous, but you know, really does give an idea of what the cultural aspects of the town are. And then secondly, which is really funny to me, is when you talk about the Colonial Theater and the guy who takes your ticket but forgets to rip it in half, that still happens, which I don't know if you meant that, and I don't want to insult anyone.
No, it's not about a person at the Colonial, but it is about a specific person at a different movie theater.
Because it has happened to me here, but it doesn't really make any difference if they rip it up, right?
Oh, no. It's, you know, I think I'm trying to capture little bits of flavor from the town and the people in the town, but I grew up in Baltimore, which was also a blue-collar type hometown, and so there were a lot of echoes of my own childhood that I was able to use in this book. And just with the library, I mean, I'm a lifelong library rat and a book enthusiast, but also the sense of history in the Phoenixville Library. I mean, it's one of the original Carnegie Libraries, and was started, I think, around 1910, 1920. And just a wonderful place. And I did my first public reading there, and it was standing room only. There was a real hunger for community and for this creative spirit that's in Phoenixville right now.
Yeah, I think Barbara, who you've been talking to, told me about, you know, how many people were there and 70 books signed. And, you know, it's so much more amazing than what happens at sometimes in Chester County Bookstore, where you have a reading and there's like five people that show up. I've been to them. So I think that's absolutely wonderful.
What was really striking was, well, first I was only related to two of them, which was great, but at least, well, I don't know, maybe a third were people who had either worked at the steel mill or had family members who worked at the steel mill and didn't know me at all, but were coming out to hear about this book that's been written about their place, and they have a lot of pride, and they should. And it was really a wonderful event.
Well, it's funny, you know, you mentioned Baltimore. Baltimore is another one of those towns, kind of like Phoenixville still is, where if you go to the Inner Harbor, yeah, it's beautiful and you can go back a street or two, but once you go back three or four streets, it's almost like you're in a different world. And in your book, you mentioned Baltimore with regard to one of the characters. So I was wondering how much of it is, always is, but how much of it is autobiographical in the sense of incidents you've had or characters, people that you've known?
Well, I wasn't a juvenile delinquent the way Sketch and Boo are, but I certainly went through the same period that they did of wanting to find my own independence and wanting to create my own future. And I think most every teenager goes through that. And also being, I've been away from Baltimore for, you know, well over 20 years now, and you still have that yearning for home or for the childhood and the place you grew up. So I'm very, very fond of Baltimore and have family there and get back as much as I can. And in many ways, Phoenixville is a very small Baltimore to me.
Yeah, I agree with that, and that's why I made the comparison. That's the question I have about Phoenixville, especially since it's close to my heart, and I guess I hate to say it, our pocketbook too, is how do we create kind of not an integration in terms of a whole, but you know, how do we move further back into the community rather than just Bridge and a couple streets behind it and Main and a couple streets behind it? How do you create that additional vibrancy?
Right.
Yeah, because you talk about, like, you talked about yuppies coming in and building houses or building stores and then realizing, oh, man, this isn't going to work, and leaving.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there was that right at the beginning when people were trying to make a go of it, but now, you know, I guess when we first moved here, my family and I, we would go into town all the time, and we were big patrons of the library or the Colonial Theater, and we were first to try most of these restaurants that came in. But we had friends who would not go into Phoenixville because they remembered it as what it was like in the 70s and early 80s. That has changed, and it's really, to answer your question, it's really on the people, on the community around the heart of town to keep that alive and to keep attracting more and more people into it. So they're doing a great job with different events, whether it's First Friday events or things like the Blob Fest that get people into town. And the reaction is always, wow, I had no idea Phoenixville is like this. And it really is a great town. It went through some tough times, but it's certainly been on the upswing for many, many years, and that'll continue.
Yeah, like I said, I certainly hope that it does for a lot of reasons. One thing that's really interesting is that, you know, it's kind of like a crossroads. It's like all roads lead to Rome. There are so many roads that come through or terminate there that can take you to Valley Forge or to Collegeville or to Limerick or, you know, right, to any of those places.
Yeah. Yeah, and you have the... It's become a bit of a bedroom community for some people. You have a lot of pharmaceutical companies up in Oaks and towards the Collegeville area that are finding good homes and good schools down in Phoenixville. And then there's also people who have been here since they were kids and they don't want to leave.
Yeah, I mean, look at the community that my brothers and I built, Eagleview, yep, which is there right at the Downingtown interchange of the Turnpike. You can live in Phoenixville and come flying down 113 or make a couple of shortcuts too, and you can be at work in 15, 20 minutes. So there's
That's
no...
right.
And you can be at the Turnpike, or you can be in Valley Forge in 10 or 15 minutes. So, yeah, I think that's a big seller, which, you know, means basically if you can be at Valley Forge in 10 minutes, you can be in New York in 2 hours. You can be at the airport on a good day in, you know, 35 or 40 or 45 minutes.
Right, or down to the Jersey Shore. I mean,
right,
it's a really good location, and that's one of the reasons we settled here, was we felt like we had access to any place we wanted to go. But and that's where we wanted to raise our kids.
Well, I could go on forever, but I think I'm running out of time here. Let me just thank you again, Rob, for being here. It's been great, different from my other interviews, because I really feel almost totally connected to you and to the book, just because its subject matter is something that we both love and care a great deal about. So whether you do a sequel or not, the next time you write or the next time we have an opportunity to have you at the bookstore, I would love to do it. And like I said, we have a big display of your books at the front, and for whatever reason or not, we sell a ton of them. So
It's a wonderful bookshop, and I really appreciate all the support, and I've loved this conversation.
So. Likewise. I actually learned a lot about the town that I didn't know, and like I said, I'll pass this on to my brothers, and I know lots of people who would love the book.
That's
so
great.
Thanks again, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you, Sam.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, that was Rob Cadigan talking about his book Phoenixville Rising, which is really cool for me since my brothers and I rebuilt the foundry, which is what the entire book is about. And like I said, when I first went into the foundry, I know all the places where the action of the book took place, which is so weird because I've never been in a situation like that interviewing an author. I think it's going to take off. Even though he's a local author, I think it's going to take off nationwide. I really do. And we sell a ton of them at the store. So next week on The Avid Reader, we're going to have J. Michael Leno, who's going to talk about his book Norman Mailer, A Double Life. This guy, Mike Lennon, knew Mailer for 35 years. And in writing the biography, he's had the cooperation of Mailer's late widow, Nora's Church, his ex-wives, all of his children, as well as his sister Barbara, which is unusual. He's also had access to Mailer's enormous cache of unpublished correspondence and papers. And he's interviewed dozens of people who knew Norman Mailer. So Norman Mailer, A Double Life, I don't know. It gives us the man in full, a remarkable and unique figure in the context of his times. It's a massive book. I'll read it by the time that I have to get this done, because I can't interview someone unless I've read the entire book. It's impossible for me. So that's who it'll be. J. Michael Lennon talking about his book, Norman Mailer, A Double Life. And as always, thanks very much. If you come by the bookshop, we got all kinds of stuff for Christmas. We've got all kinds of deals going on. Like I said, Phoenixville Rising. First thing you do when you walk into the store, you'll see a table of these books, not only because I like the book, because they sell like crazy. So as always, thanks a lot for listening today, and we hope you'll be listening next week when we talk with J. Michael Lennon about his book, Norman Mailer, A Double Life.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.